really helped each other. We mentored each other. You know, when we had questions about how to do things within our family or business, we were a sisterhood. We were a trusted group. And I think all of us felt we needed to hear some views outside of our own. And we've maintained very strong ties.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. This week, the second in our Atlanta Interfaith miniseries, it was a pleasure to get to go and meet so many of these people, actually in person, and see what's happening in the interfaith world. This is a place, Atlanta, where this has been going on for decades, and it's related to civil rights, but it's really an example to me of what can happen for good in a community when people like this guest, like Sherry Frank, take it upon themselves to do good. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. Heather Bigley's with me, our senior producer.
Hello.
She, clear back in the way she was raised, was really raised in a household where her uncle's clothing store served both white and black, which was a rarity in that era. And when she realized that, I think that sort of sparked something into her for her future.
Yeah, Sherry Frank has served on committees of the United Way, the Atlanta Regional Commission, and the Community Foundation of Greater Atlanta. In addition, she was on the national boards of the National Council of Jewish Women and Mizan, a Jewish response to hunger. She has a memoir called A Passion to Serve, Memoirs of a Jewish Activist. And she might have said Jewish feminist, because I think that's really key to her story as well. Not only is she interested in inter-ethnic and interfaith relations, but she's inspired by the strength of the women around her.
And she also includes some how-to elements. In fact, I'm going to quote her to her in just a few moments about several points that she makes about how you work in a community to educate each other.
We're going to jump into this interview where she actually talks about how she knows Reverend Gerald Durley and how they've traveled together.
I love Gerald. Now, we've traveled the world together. Mm. We've traveled to lots of places together. He's wonderful. And we're called upon often to talk about Black Jewish relations at teen retreats, at adult retreats, and a lot of things to share what we've done together and what's brought us together and what trouble spots we've been able to move beyond. And of course, my closest, dearest friend in the Black community was Congressman John Lewis. And I'm proud now to serve on his foundation board he created before he died to continue his work.
What a remarkable figure, but a national figure that lots of us know some of his history.
You know, the conscience of Congress. I mean, a guy who constantly built bridges and constantly sought peace and would never be distracted from the mission of moving forward. He just believed in a brighter day. As sick as he was, he got every energy he could put together to go stand with the Black Lives Matter folks because he saw in them the future of a new youth voice. He was a model. My family all met him. Thank goodness my children and love him and speak about him too.
What you did in activism over the years and bringing people together, was that an outgrowth, do you think, of your faith?
Totally. I would say two things. First of all, as a young married, I've always been an activist in high school, in college, whatever. As a young married, when I moved to New Jersey, I looked for what young people were doing, and they were involved. The women were involved in National Council of Jewish Women, which is an organization devoted to community service and education and working in the inner city schools or working where the need is. So I would say that really channeled my interest in community service outside of the white community. But so much of it, because I went to a Jewish organization, was the whole commitment of repairing the world, of tikkun olam, of doing something with the gifts that we have. So I would say my religion drove a lot of it.
Did you ever have people in your own faith community say, hey, there's enough to do right here. Why are you doing this outreach? Was there questioning?
Well, I've always been able to do both. I mean, I think we have to take care of our own first. So I've always belonged to a synagogue. I've always worked as a Zionist to support Israel. I've always worked within Jewish agencies. But the agencies that I really love the most, like National Council of Jewish Women, American Jewish Committee, are those that reach out and build bridges, because I think that that's part of living a full life, to experience the other.
One chapter in your book is called interreligious affairs, love thy neighbor as thyself. And I really love each chapter you begin with a very thoughtful quote. In fact, if I just read all the quotes, we'd have a pretty good program here.
I had a good time looking once I read, I knew I was going to do 18 chapters. And I first was going to call the book Living a Chai Life using the Hebrew letter for Chai 18. So I didn't end up using the title of Living a Chai Life, but I knew I was going to have 18 chapters. And when I wrote each one, then I looked for a quote that really fit it.
Well, this one, we forfeit the right to worship God when we humiliate the image of God in other people, from Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Wow. If we could remember that, we forfeit the right to worship God when we humiliate the image of God in other people.
Atlanta has its rich civil rights history, which in its own talks about building bridges. But post-civil rights, the World Pilgrims and the Faith Alliance of Metro Atlanta and the Umbrella Intergroup Relations Agencies have really played a major role in sustaining it and moving it past black and white. And part of it is World Pilgrims. And that quote about, you know, seeing God in every individual really comes alive when you travel with Christians, Jews, and Muslims and observe each other's holy sites.
Talk to me about doing that. Was that something you organized or decided as a group to do?
You know, it's probably 30 or 40 years old now, and hundreds of Atlantans have experienced it. So, you know, when you travel, you develop relationships that are not peripheral, they're deep. You know, every other night we are having a roommate that's different than ourselves. And, you know, sleeping in a room with someone who follows Islam and is getting up, in, you know, early in the morning to pray. Mm-hmm. Being in each other's holy space is very profound. We got to the point when we would go to mosques that we were wearing scarves and kind of felt the way our Islamic sisters felt. And the experience, you know, of observing Sunday morning at holy places and giving charity and having folks observe the warmth of Shabbat as Jews sat around the table going through our rituals was very enriching and bridge building and created a lot of respect for one another.
Well, traveling with Muslims, Jews, and Christians, you'd get a whole weekend of Friday, Saturday, and Sunday religious observance.
Traveled places where there was history for those traditions, from Turkey to South Africa. We've traveled to Morocco, Spain.
You start this chapter by saying, the South is known as the Bible Belt for good reason. For a great many, religion plays a defining role in their lives, impacting much of the civic and political arena. And I really love what you did to build bridges. And you're talking clear back to, you had to deal with the Klan, actually. When you would put together events.
You know, we dealt with challenges. I mean, today we deal with anti-Semitism and some anti-Zionism. Early on, we dealt with some of the black issues like Minister Farrakhan and his bigotry. But, you know, through it all, we had so many shared experiences that we could have difficult conversations, not always agree. And, you know, it's interesting when Andy Young talks about black-Jewish relations, he says, go to a black church any Sunday morning. We're reading the Old Testament. You know, your tradition is our tradition. So there are things that bind us in ways that we sometimes don't stop to think and appreciate.
One thing I thought I really need to make note of is in that interfaith chapter, you actually had a set of five goals that were put together in discussion with other people, the Faith Alliance of Metro Atlanta, really stating a mission statement and goals. And do you mind if I read these five?
Sure.
Because they're so good. The first one talks about communal prayer, fostering interfaith and multi-faith occasions for prayer, meditation, celebration. Talk to me about what that means to you.
It's fun to go to each other's houses of worship. That by itself is very inspiring, and particularly on special moments, you know, holidays and whatever. But the other is gathering together in a sukkah for Jews to experience and share the Harvest Festival. I've helped put together multiple women's seders and interfaith seders and unity seders. You know, the whole idea of liberation and freedom is universal. So those are examples. Today, American Jewish Committee continues to do a powerful unity seder across religion and race. Mm. And I've done multiple women's interfaith seders. So prayer and holiday observance and Sabbath and are all, you know, going to church on a Sunday and then having supper and talking about the experience, the music. I mean, there's nothing like the music at a Black church.
Some of the other points you mentioned are education on religion. So actually hearing about what other people believe, multi-faith and interfaith dialogue concerning issues of the day, like how can we approach what needs to be done, we all see needs to be done in our community, cooperation, networking. It seems so valuable that you made friendships. You went out of your way to create friendship. In fact, will you tell me about this beautiful picture in your book that shows six women from the Jewish congregation and six Black Christian women, I believe.
I helped start the Atlanta Black Jewish Coalition, and we brought Blacks and Jews together in 1982 when the Voting Act was up for renewal. Boy, it's been killed in recent years, but we pulled Blacks and Jews together for advocacy on behalf of the renewal. When it was renewed, the Black Jewish Coalition continued and continues today. On the 10th anniversary of the coalition, we did an evening dinner at the home of Janetta Cole, who was president of Spelman, at Sisters Chapel, which was where she lived. And as a result of that, the six Jewish women and six Black women that were there that night, I have to say that there were about 24 of us. The men thought it was a great evening. They went to bed, went on with their business the next day. The women were agitated and said, this is great. We've got to do more. And as a result of that, the 12 of us continued for 30 years. And so we've been to Harlem together. We've been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington together. We traveled to Israel together. And back when we started and life was simpler, we were meeting every 2 or 3 months. Now we meet a couple times a year, but we never let the year go by without having a holiday dinner.
So these were ladies like you who you were supporting a family, you had children. What was it that motivated you to say, I have to take this extra time to do this thing?
You know, one of the people in the group is Shirley Franklin, the mayor of Atlanta. Mm-hmm. One of the people in the group is Ingrid Saunders Jones, who headed the Coca-Cola Foundation. There were people in the group who were political leaders. We really helped each other beyond just having dinner together, going to the theater together, traveling together. We mentored each other. You know, when we had questions about how to do things within our family or business, we were a sisterhood. We were a trusted group. And I think all of us felt we needed to hear some views outside of our own. And we've maintained very strong ties.
That phrase, we thought we needed to hear views outside our own. You hosted so many people because Atlanta is such an international city. It's a transportation hub. It's a business place. Tell me about meeting the Dalai Lama.
Well, that was just quite exceptional. We got a call that he was going to be speaking at Emory and that he wanted to meet the faith community. And someone came to me because we had started FAMA, the Faith Alliance of Metro Atlanta, which has morphed into the other big interfaith coalitions. But we met every month at the American Jewish Committee office, and when I kind of provided the staff support for it. Mm-hmm. And they came to us and said, you have the best list of all the interfaith folks in Atlanta, and the Dalai Lama wants to meet with the faith community. So we called the temple, and we've always had rabbis working with us in this interfaith work. And people got very excited about meeting the Dalai Lama, and we just packed the temple. And there was a little private gathering first with some rabbis and leaders, and it was awesome. You know, we also had the opportunity with Bishop Tutu being a visiting guest at Emory and opportunities over the years to meet him and hear him.
Well, I love this line. The Dalai Lama, that most famous Buddhist of Buddhist monks, is the last guy I'd expect to see behind a lectern with the Hebrew words Shema Yisrael emblazoned on it.
Shema Yisrael, Hero Israel, right?
Yeah, what a beautiful moment and kind of symbolic of what you've had been trying to accomplish. Now, it's not just interfaith, but motivated by faith, it was also interethnic. Now, it sounds like because of how you grew up, you just saw the humanity in everyone.
You know, Atlanta is a diverse community. And the Asian community, the Hispanic community is growing. We have an amazing group of consulates here in Atlanta. And the Indian community is very strong here. And in the years that I worked with the American Jewish Committee, it was really our goal to build bridges. And so we reached out to the Indian community, the Hispanic and the Asian community, and did dialogues and did programs and did some of the very goals that have been sharing experiences, getting into each other's places. Sometimes it was a holy place. Sometimes it was a cultural place.
You know, there was a history of the Ebenezer Baptist Church there in downtown Atlanta where Dr. King preached. You mentioned Martin Luther King Sr., but also working together with the temple, that they worked together for civil rights progress. And I don't know if young people today know that in some of those marches, along with some white Christians, there were a lot of Jewish people who marched for Black civil rights.
Look, today people don't know their history. You know, they don't know Black Jewish history. They don't know the history of our country. They don't know the history of the world. We're in a country where people don't speak enough languages and understand enough cultures. But we try to tell the story. At the American Jewish Committee, we have a Black Jewish teen initiative that goes through the high school years. We have retreats that bring people together to tell the story. We have the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival, which is one of the biggest Jewish festivals in the country. Several years ago, the film that won the best film of the whole two-week festival, and that was the opening night film, was a film called Shared Legacies that tells the story of the Black Jewish Alliance. So we continue to find ways to tell the story, but it's never enough.
Well, we had the chance last week to meet with a congregant from Ebenezer Baptist and from the temple who sing together.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, nothing equals the history of Ebenezer and the temple. You know, the temple bombing and you know, even today, Reverend Dr. Senator Warnock and Rabbi Berg's relationship. But the relationship between a lot of synagogues and churches and mosques is really quite rich in Atlanta.
Tell me a little bit about your origins in your home life.
I grew up with a mother and a father, a brother and a sister. My father had a heart attack and died suddenly when I was 11. My brother was 8. So we were very much a single parent family, very close to my mother's sister-in-law, who also was a widow and had a son and daughter. So oftentimes we were a family of six, two women with two daughters and two sons. And it wasn't particularly a religious home that we observed all the Jewish holidays. But I think the thing that my mother taught me mostly was how valuable family is. And that you can survive as a single parent family, because I was later divorced with 4 young kids. And my dad was an insurance agent. When he passed away, she went and took an exam and started selling insurance. So I saw her as an independent woman. So she gave me a lot of kind of strength and role modeling in those ways, but not so much religious.
And I'm wondering if there were things that along the way sort of challenged you or made you decide, yes, I really want to stick with my tradition.
Well, I've always been a feminist and from an early age. And so I was very, very intrigued with women in Judaism and the role of women in Judaism, and particularly engaged as it really began to open up. I would say that was part of it. And part of what I think really led me into the whole world of interreligious affairs that I began to wonder about when people kept asking, where's my affinity for Black Jewish relations? Mm-hmm. My dad had a brother. And he ran a men's shop, and he would pick me up on weekends in the summer and have me come down to the shop with him and wait on customers. And I sold ties and helped people as a men's shop. And I didn't realize till later that the clientele was primarily Black. And when my uncle passed away, Daddy King preached the eulogy.
And Daddy King being Martin Luther King Sr.,
and I realized that my Uncle Joe's store was one of the few places that African Americans could buy clothes, try on clothes, get credit. And I began to think that probably had a real impact on me as a young teenager, because I didn't see difference, or I didn't see African Americans as any different than the white customers.
That was unusual at that time in a business.
It was. It was very unusual. And I don't think I realized it till 5 years, you know, after I did it. I was doing this in my early teenage years before I went to college and got married and moved out of Atlanta. But hearing Daddy King preach about my Uncle Joe at the funeral made me really realize, wow, what an unusual store that was and what unusual clientele that was.
I have to ask about this beautiful story of when you, for the first time,
Talis.
Yes.
Tally. So, you know, I've been a feminist for a long time, and I'm very, very thrilled that there are women that are rabbis, and I gravitate to them. But I had an adult bat mitzvah because when I was 13, girls weren't having bat mitzvahs, only boys were. And for a long time, I contemplated wearing a tallit and wasn't ready.
And maybe we'll explain, that's a prayer shawl.
A prayer shawl, right, mm-hmm. that men wear, women don't wear. And every bar mitzvah kid wears one. And a few women were wearing it in my synagogue, but, you know, I just really wasn't ready. But right before the Gulf War, when I went to Israel and there was no travel, no tourists there, and they opened some of the old city shops for us, and I said, oh, I've got to spend some money now, but Israel needs, you know, some tourism. And I thought, oh, wow, maybe this is the moment to buy a tallit. And I did not put it on for several weeks, but I brought it home. I also wanted a pink one. I mean, I've looked at a lot of them, but I didn't want it to look like the white and blue or white and black ones that every man wears. I wanted it to be a feminist one. I fell in love with my pink one. But it's interesting, shortly after I returned in January and February, my mother passed away. You say a memorial prayer on the anniversary of when they die and for the 30 days after they die. I thought this is the time that I'm going to put on my tallis. And it's awesome. I feel because it touches you. It's like I feel her presence and God's presence when I wear it. And I can really relate to the women of Islam that wear the scarf. There's something tangible you feel that separates you, that's very special and holy, and touches you to God.
And I know this is a personal question, but as you look back on this lifetime of service, do you feel approval from God? Or all along the way, did you feel like there was some helping hand behind and guiding you?
I do think God is with me in the challenges, but I think I mostly see God in my children and grandchildren and know that I've demonstrated ways that they're following. And that, to me, that is reward enough.
What a great tradition you've established.
My wish for people in general is that they would take care of themselves, their own family and community. It's got to begin at home. But your life is so enriched when you reach beyond, and the country needs us so desperately to reach out to one another. So much written lately about loneliness. And I just feel that reaching out and touching someone different and knowing your neighbors and your community is really the way never to feel lonely.
Many thanks to Sherry Frank for speaking with us, and special thanks to Stephanie Merling for her work on our behalf in our Atlanta Interfaith miniseries. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Ebert, Katarina Martinich, and James Sturdivant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Ashton Parkinson, and Lauren Sandberg. Spread the word about In Good Faith by leaving a comment and subscribing to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. We think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. Our YouTube page is youtube.com/@in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join us again soon, right here in Good Faith. Hi, Stephen Cap Perry here, host of In Good Faith. Here's another podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts I hope you'll check out. What I Love is Real. You know that saying, real recognize real? That's Lisa on The Lisa Show. Lisa Valentine Clark is a comedian, she's a believer, a single mother, and on The Lisa Show podcast, you'll hear from the Council of Moms, a genius idea, which is actually one of my favorite parts of her show, and you'll hear about the challenges of life, parenting, mental health questions, social issues. Yes, you'll hear from experts, but also from people discussing their where the rubber meets the road life experience. It's The Lisa Show, wherever you get your podcasts.